Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. I've been thinking about happiness. This country was founded in great measure on the idea that everyone who lives here is entitled to seek happiness. And right now we are having a political upheaval because various people have different ideas of what constitutes happiness for them and what constitutes a society that is happy. But happiness is very personal. Everyone wants to live a happy life. And when you think about it, we can define happiness in a number of different ways, and we can feel happy in a number of different ways. And some of the ways that I thought of, we can feel happy when we feel creative, or when we feel loved, or when we feel admired and accepted, or when we feel successful in our work and in our projects and in our hobbies. And we can feel happy when we seek and do obtain wealth or possessions. And we can also feel happy when we feel in control of our life. Now, the first of those that I mentioned, the first six, are all very possible. Feeling creative and feeling loved and feeling successful, those are all possible. They rely a lot on our vision and our enthusiasm and our values and how hard we want to work. And there's some luck involved also. But the last one, feeling in control of our life, this one is a problem. You know, we may believe that we can control our life, or at least part of it. And we may believe that we do control our life. But actually, it's not true. It is not possible to put life under control. And that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. It's not possible to put life under control because, as we know, at any time, something unexpected and unwanted will happen in our life. Many times, something that we don't like will occur in our life. And we've all experienced things like we're having a conversation with a friend or maybe a relative, and the friend says something, very innocently says something, but we feel hurt by it because somehow the words don't strike us right. Or we may be involved in an accident, or someone we're close to maybe in an accident. Or maybe you have an appointment and it is suddenly and unexpectedly broken. An appointment you counted on is broken. Or maybe somebody's spouse announces that the marriage no longer works. Or maybe an employer goes out of business and everyone is laid off. These things occur frequently and they're quite common in the world we live in. It is because, as we know, and as Suzuki Roshi very quietly advised us, things change. Things change all the time. We cannot prevent disruptions. We cannot prevent surprises or unplanned events. And quite often, what happens is that we become upset, we become angry, we become sad, and we might even say to the world, why did this happen? We might ask our friends and relatives that question, why did this happen to me? And we might say, this was not supposed to happen. I had things under control. This was not supposed to happen. Now I have to change everything. When we feel this way, it is an indication that we are suffering. But the truth is, there is no such thing as supposed to be or not supposed to be. This was not supposed to be. There's no such thing. And to think so, to think that there is such a thing as supposed to be, this is a big misunderstanding. And it's the cause of of problems for many people. Life cannot be put under full control by organizing it, by planning, by thinking things through. These are the things we do in our daily life. Planning our day, organizing our projects, giving careful thought to our activities. These are things we do. And there's a term for it, usually called due diligence. But there's never any guarantee. Even though we do our complete and fullest due diligence, there's no guarantee that we can control our life. And thinking that we can, and clinging to the desire for control is very painful. Because we cannot hold life in our hand or in our mind as if it were a possession. And when we consider life according to our practice, we realize there's no such thing as a life. There's no such thing. It may seem so. We may look at our own history and where we are today, and we may say, this is the life I've led. This is my life. But what we feel as a life is not a tangible thing. What we feel is our life is nothing but a collection of memories and experiences. And by continually replaying them over and over, we feel they represent a life, something we can call a life. And somebody may write your biography and present your history and say, here was his life, here was her life. But it'll just be words on paper. It doesn't really exist. Because what truly exists, when we see our existence through the lens of our practice, what truly exists is only this moment of time. As Dogen said in his lecture, Uji, being time, he said, everything and every being in this world is time. Every being in this world is time. It's another way of saying what you think is your life is really nothing more than time. Our usual thinking is that when we are in control of this life, we will have success. We will have peace of mind. And we will have the good life. But then, you know, things happened, things changed. Think of the experienced and well-trained downhill skier who crashes into a tree. Or one of your close family members suddenly becomes ill. Or your company announces a sudden layoff or a merger, and everybody gets a pink slip. How do we feel about being in control when those things happen? In our everyday world, in our everyday life, it's necessary for us, for people, to establish and follow a way to live together, to live in community. And that way, the community or the society can function in harmony when we have a way to live together. So we set up rules and laws to establish what we call the way to be together. There's traffic laws, and there are laws about conducting business, and there are rules about attending school, and there are rules everywhere. Sometimes we don't like them, but they have a very important function. They keep us together. And when we agree to do those rules together, we can be in harmony. So to have harmony in our community, we all agree to establish certain rules. Then things can go well, and we indeed do feel in control because we're following the rules together. And so when something happens in our life that we don't care for, that we don't like, that disturbs us, when life is out of control, we think, well, it's because life isn't following the rules. In other words, the rules we expected it to follow. And that's when we say, this wasn't supposed to happen. We have these rules. But our true nature is not governed by rules that are designed by people. Who we really are is not governed by rules, by human rules. It is people, it is us who establish rules to provide harmony in daily life. The daily life, which is transient and temporary. But when we can feel the essence of our true nature, independent of whatever rules we make for ourselves, then we can live in the inherent harmony of our existence. Because life, our existence, our time on the earth, as an awake, aware, alert being, that life is always following the truth, it's always following its true nature, even when the events of life are not in control, they're out of control. Even then, life is always going according to its true nature. No matter what we humans do, sometimes good things, sometimes not such good things, life is always going according to its true nature. So we shouldn't confuse the rules we make up with our true nature. We should not confuse rules with reality. There is only one rule of life. Things change. We cannot enforce anything to stay the same. We cannot enforce anything to behave as we desire it to behave. There is only change. In our relationships with each other, in our conversations, in our meetings, in our social time, we refer to what goes on every day as the real world. You know, sometimes we joke, we might say, after meditation, I'm going back to the real world. After being at Tassajara in a practice period, I'm going to go back to the real world. As if ordinary life and everyday life is the real thing. But what seems real today in the so-called real world, what seems real today will be different tomorrow. So what is reality in the large sense? It is not, reality is not about appearances or feelings or memories. They are transient, they are always changing. Trying to create a reality from appearances and feelings and memories, trying to create a reality from them is trying to gain control. Trying to make everyday life follow your rules or our rules. When we try to make everyday life follow our personal rules, it means we are striving to gain advantage over others. But when we strive for things such as gaining attention and gaining advantage and building up our pride, when we strive for these things, we are actually out of control. We are holding on to an idea of what is real. But the idea is only an image. And the image is not reality. Our practice helps us recognize this confusion and get beyond it. So instead of trying so hard to control life and enforce the rules that we prefer, our practice encourages us to join with everyone and everything, and not to pursue our own personal preferences and to control life to be in accordance with what we desire. Our practice encourages us to live in accordance with true nature and accept the true reality of all things and the truth of transiency. The point is, we need to understand the way that life is moving naturally and not worry so much about the rules we want it to follow. What is the natural flow, independent of what I want and of the way I think it should be? So we pay attention in our practice to recognize and understand the way our existence is moving, its natural rhythm. But at the same time, we are alive, and we have to express this existence that we have, this thing that we call a life. We have to pay attention to how events and people are going moment to moment. And then we have to share what we have learned by our paying attention. I think that there is a formula for Buddhism in the modern world to be very active and engaged in our experiences as they happen moment by moment, and at the same time, experience the Dharma unfold. Our practice encourages us to include quiet times during our day and to set aside our own feelings and our own ideas, our own habits, and our own beliefs, and to listen to others. And this is not just for politeness. It is letting the Dharma unfold. Setting aside our own preferences and listening to others is how we understand how Buddha speaks. Now, people may think that they may say to themselves, or they may say to others, when I express myself, when I express what I want, when I express my own desires and pursue them, then I am in control. But actually, the thinking that by giving our attention to others means giving up control to them is a misunderstanding. If you're in a conversation with someone and they're speaking, and you feel the urge to make a rebuttal, to express your own opinion. There's a common belief that you should do so. Even if you have to interrupt, you should always express yourself. Because if we don't, it may feel we are giving control to the other person when we remain silent. But when we remain silent, just pay attention, give our attention to others, and let them express themselves. This is our practice. It is our acknowledging that something is unfolding. It's not just simple politeness. It is practicing the Dharma. So encouraging others to express themselves rather than insisting that they permit us to express ourselves. When we encourage others to express themselves, that is unfolding. Then we feel confident. Then we feel in control. When our understanding and our attitude is that the Dharma is always unfolding, then we have no problems, independent of whatever difficulty we may find ourselves in at a moment, or what disappointment or tragedy might have just occurred. When we realize that the true nature is always expressing itself and the Dharma is unfolding, we will have no problems. With that attitude, we encourage our own independence, and we will encourage the independence of others. So to encourage freedom in the world, from the founding principle of this country, which has up until recently been admired by all the other countries of the world, the freedom, the principles of freedom that were established in this country, in order to encourage that freedom in the world, we first have to find our own freedom. But if we insist on expressing only our own freedom and ignoring the freedom of others, this is trying to be in control. And as we know from history, when this country started, there's a part of it that did not allow for the freedom of certain people, because they tried to be in control. And the people who enforced those rules, well, they were in control and they had freedom, but it was not freedom in the true sense. Because if we insist on having more control than others, this is actually no control. That's when we are always at risk of feeling the world is not going my way, or other people won't accept what I do or what I say. When we have those kinds of attitudes, it means we are allowing others to be in control of us. The world won't go my way. Others won't accept me. That means we are allowing them to be in control of us. So if we try to boss other people around, if we try to show off, if we try to manipulate others, it is trying to control people and life. But the opposite is true. Trying to control people and the world around us means we are out of control. So if you ever discover that you are disappointed by the way things are going, it would be good to reflect and ask a question. Have I been trying to control my life? It's best not to try to control or insist or rely on rules that people make up. But by not being so heavily reliant on rules is not being passive. It is not taking a casual attitude, a whatever attitude. It means we are entering our life moment by moment, continuously. Entering life continuously with an awareness of reality. Our practice is about paying attention to the unfolding of the present moment. This is our practice. When in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in one of his lectures, Suzuki Roshi said, "It is the readiness of mind that is wisdom." This simple statement is quite profound, actually. It means your ready mind, your Zen mind, your ready mind is beyond any ideas of happiness. Readiness of mind is wisdom. That goes beyond any ideas of happiness. And that is our practice. So when we have this readiness of mind that he spoke about, when we are fully aware of and engaged in the present moment, we can find the confidence that says, I can take care of this situation in this moment, whether it's pleasant or whether it's unpleasant. I can take care. I know how to respond. I have a ready mind and I can respond. In this way, it is the readiness of mind that is happiness. And this is our practice. You. So I would like to ask if anybody has any questions about rules and reality and control. Anybody? Oh, hi, Dave.
Hi, Les. Thank you so much for your talk. It was such a rich and resonant thing. I hardly know where to begin saying anything about it. I think I'll have to go back and listen to the recording a couple of times. But one thing that really struck me was you talked about our tradition in this country of freedom, and there's that memorable phrase about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And whenever I hear that, somewhere in the back of my mind, that third thing, the pursuit of happiness, always strikes me as being, I don't know, somehow sort of shallow compared to the other two. And I think the thing that bothers me is not the word happiness, it's the word pursuit. You know, what does it mean to pursue? It means that you go after something and you exert it, catch up with it and get it and put it under control. And we talked about all of the different kinds of happiness, you know, about being creative, being loved, being successful. It seems like there's always a danger that this notion of control is going to sort of poison those and make them into dualistic, you know, it's a happiness versus unhappiness. And how can we pursue the happiness and control it and keep the unhappiness away? And I guess it just all leads up to your final line there of readiness of mind in our practice is happiness. So these days when we're trying so hard to grapple with what are the underlying principles of freedom in our country, it seems to me that the kind of insights that you've given us tonight about what it really means to live a life where we can appreciate happiness, but not have to pursue it and control it is just of incredible value. So thank you so much for that.
Thanks, Dave. Hi, Umar.
Hi, Les. Question came to my mind when Dave was talking about this whole pursuit of happiness. I was thinking, why not start with happiness? Why do we have to run after it? If we start with happiness, won't it be easier for us to do everything? If we live with the joy of the moment, then what is in front of us is okay.
You know, when the practice first came to the U.S. back in the 60s, Suzuki Roshi came, and we were all desperately reading the Buddhist texts to try to understand what Zen practice was. And there was this notion of enlightenment. And we all had the idea that we're supposed to pursue enlightenment and gain enlightenment. But the practice tells us, and we started hearing in those days, we are already inherently enlightened. There's nothing to pursue. Just have to express it.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me, and in line with what you just said, it occurred to me that what we humans do is we squander our inherent enlightenment.
Yeah.
By pursuing it, we squander it. And by pursuing happiness, it avoids us.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Dave.
Yes, Seth. Thank you for your talk. I enjoy listening to the resonant way in which you speak. It's bridges a long gap of my lifetime. I always appreciate it. I've dealt with the issue of pursuit of happiness, and the solution that I've chosen is to give pursuit the alternate definition, which is the practice of. Like the pursuit of archery is the practice of archery, the practice of being happy. I like that definition, and it diffuses the chasing issue, and it points more toward expression. As usual, Dharma talks are addressed to what I always assume is an adult audience. And I'll confess that one of my own self-incriminations is in part being a failure as a parent. And what I tried to do, because I got married in my middle 40s, was I tried to apply everything that I'd learned from psychologists and psychiatrists and Zen teachers to life in a marriage and life with a child. And at the end of it all, I've decided that that was a mistaken practice, that some other context exists between parents and children that has its own set of rules. The most offensive rule was from one of my psychologists who said, treat your son as if he were a dog. That deeply offended me, and I didn't do it. But years later, you know what? I could see the truth in that. Or I could see that I should not have dismissed it so entirely. So my question is there a different set of rules for being a parent? Or should one expect the rules of Zen life to apply to 10-year-olds? Thank you.
I think the best thing a parent can do for a child is to watch them carefully and see how they express themselves and see what they are trying to express. Watch them struggle in trying to express what they don't yet understand, and encourage it. And encourage it. Later on, you may have to apply some rules about behavior and not making a mess and cleaning up your room and washing the dishes and all that. And we have to do those things, you know, to keep the family in harmony. But if we really want to practice intimately with our children, we have to start by giving them our full attention and acknowledging them and encouraging them to continue to express themselves and be very, very wary of criticizing. So the rules given to us by Zen masters, or psychologists, or psychiatrists, or friends, they are rules. We have to discover what works best for us in terms of how we see the world unfolding. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Very thoughtful
very
question. Very
Thank
thoughtful
you.
Question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, hi, Phil.
Hi, Les. Thank you for your talk. And I found myself just thinking of my own experience in Zen practice, but the things that you're talking about, the kind of dialogue between the true nature of whether it's ourselves or our life, the larger life around us, and our desires to do this or that or to control it. Zen practice, especially if I look back, just beginning Zen practice, can be kind of a microcosm of the subject matter of your lecture, that all these things can come up in the way we use or look at our practice. And I wonder if you might say something about practice and the desire to control things versus practice with a desire, with a wish, a desire to connect with our true nature. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it seems like both kind of come up in Zen practice and in different people and in different times. I don't know if I was clear in asking a question, but I just was really aware that of how much, and it's more obvious looking back, how much my practice was an effort to control things, control my life, and how I felt out of control. Sometimes if I felt like my practice was out of control, but it was just anyhow.
Okay. You know, when we first start to practice, it's very likely that we are not aware of the habits and tendencies we have that give us problems. But as we continue our Zazen practice and our mind becomes more alert and more aware, we begin to see those things about ourselves. And one of the things we may notice is, oh, I'm trying to be in control. And noticing that tendency in ourselves is a big breakthrough. And it's always good when we recognize it ourselves and we don't have somebody else point it out to us. When we recognize it ourselves through our continued practice of awareness, it's a marvelous insight. It's one of those small enlightenments that we have that Suzuki Roshi used to reference. He said, you will have a small enlightenment and you will have many of them. It's necessary for you to have many of them. And I think what he meant was, as we practice, more and more we discover these things about ourselves. Little insights, little recognitions that he called small enlightenments. And when we can see what we've been doing out of habit, then we have a chance to modify. One of the things that, you know, aggressive people do, and maybe including people in the current modern world in our culture, you know, we have a tendency when somebody is doing something, or performing a task and we don't agree with it, we interrupt and say, oh, let me show you how to do that. Trying to control them. It's better to say, can I help you? Is there something I can do to be of assistance? So acknowledging people rather than dismissing people is a fundamental quality of our practice. And that kind of attitude holds communities together. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Les. That's a beautiful way to frame the environment of our practice. It feels as a place where there's compassion. It enables us to see ourselves. Thank you.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Les. I've taken that in your discussion today, you talk little, if anything, of self and of Zazen. And, what brought me this practice was dealing with myself and dealing with Zazen. And, but the longer I've been doing this, I resonate more with what you talked about today, which is about relationships and community. And I think that, I don't think those are opposite of self and Zazen. I just think they're part of, relationships are expressed, are expressions of our Buddha nature. And I don't think there's many people who could, become enlightened, so to speak, without others. There may be some hermits who could do that, but be nice. But no, I just think relationships are fraught with all kinds of stuff. But so I think that they're really kind of the ultimate puzzle. So thanks for the talk today.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
Teresa.
Yes, Les. Oh no, I didn't have a question, but
oh, I see your hand.
but I can have one actually. I was thinking. Thank you for saying encouraging us to listening to others. I was intrigued by what you said, that when we are listening to others, that's how we are seeing Dharma unfold. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. If I understood you correctly, if I listened to you correctly.
When we listen to each other, even though we may have a different idea or opinion about what they're saying, and we may not even agree with what they're saying, our understanding of truth is different than what they're expressing, even when that happens. If we have the attitude of acceptance towards them and an attitude of acknowledgement of them, that's more important than getting it right, than having a duel over my opinion or your opinion or my experience or yours. That may be healthy sometimes when we have a problem to solve and we share ideas. Like that movie you saw the other night. Our acceptance, our quiet acceptance with full attention is far more important to our well-being and our caring for each other than whether we are right or the other person is right. So by being attentive and quiet and accepting when somebody else is expressing their understanding, I feel this is the essence. This is the essence of our spiritual practice.
Megan?
Yes. Oh, just
Megan.
Yes. You know, I feel like when I'm meditating, I'm trying very hard to control myself.
Oh.
Just not move, not think your thoughts, do all these things. And I think it's, you know, but it, how does that fit in? Because I understand you don't control other people, and but yet it seems like meditation is a lot of control on my side, just to be able to do it and to, you know, let thoughts pass and all that.
Megan, do you do any sewing? You sew?
Not very much.
Okay. Well, a little bit?
A little bit. I mend.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, you know, when you first tried to thread a needle, when you first tried it, maybe as a child, it doesn't go so well at first.
Right. Yeah.
And if you try really hard to do it, you probably can't.
Mm-hmm.
But if you relax and just, okay, I'll try it. That didn't work. I'll try it again. I'll try it again. I'll try it again. And through the experience, the repetition, we get it. And after that, it becomes a little easier each time.
Yeah.
So I think the same is true with Zazen. No need to thread the needle on the first try. Just come back the next moment and come back the next moment and come back the next moment. And little by little, we develop a skill of threading that needle and being aware.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. I think that's true.
I have trouble with that myself. I think maybe we have time for one more, I think. Diane.
Hi, Les. Thank you for your talk. I'm the ultimate control freak. And as Megan said, I try for perfection and I try to control myself and everything around me. And about a month ago, I woke up with a really stiff neck. And as you were talking, my neck started tightening up and tightening up again. And I'm thinking, oh my God, it's so hard to let go and just be. It's a constant, for me, it's a constant struggle toward perfection, toward fixing things, toward making everything right. And I think it's tied me up in knots, and it's beginning to to show up in, physically for me. And so your talk is very timely for me. It's reminding me to get back to basics, get back to just letting things unfold and acceptance of what's real. Anyway, your talk really tied me up in knots, but
sorry.
It also made me really look at, oh, this is why your neck is hurting, Diane. I need to just take a big breath and let go. So I miss hearing your wisdom.
wouldn't it be nice if somebody could reach out of their square and reach over to your square and give you a massage?
I'm doing.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Wouldn't that be a good new feature of Zoom if you could do that?
Wow. I get it. That's artificial intelligence.
There we go.
Maybe not. Maybe I don't understand AI.
Les, I don't have another question, but I just wanted to thank David for shedding light on this alternate definition of pursuit. You know, I mean, if you just go and look up the word pursuit in the dictionary, the first thing that comes up is sort of like reminds you of like police in police cars chasing people. But this other notion that it's a sustained or regular activity, like, say, our practice, seems very helpful. And if you put that together with your definition of happiness without control, which sounds an awful lot like the Buddha's notion of composure, then really, if you say pursuit of happiness in that sense, you could really paraphrase it as the practice of composure. So thank you, David.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.